live from the NBC News radio broadcasting studios of KCAA, 1050 AM, 102.3 FM, and 106.5 FM, located in beautiful sunny California. Well, it's a little overcast today, a little rain. Thank you for tuning into the Water Zone today. Good afternoon, I'm Rob Starr. Mr. Mike Barron is off for the day, having a relaxing day, hopefully off his feet, and listening to the show, and I hope he's doing good. So I kind of miss my pal Mikeypedia. He tells me lots of stuff, and he's a good man and knows lots of stuff. That's why I call him Mikeypedia. He's my go-to encyclopedia man. And anything you want to know about hydraulics and things of that sort, that man knows it. He's just great. Anyway, excuse me. I thought I was getting over my pneumonia and bronchitis, but I still have a little bit of cough left. Next week is World Water Day on Thursday. And so we're going to have some special guests on for that. Also, I will be informing people locally here of the various water agencies who are having Earth Day activities, anywhere from the Inland Empire and Orange County and Riverside counties. So there's lots of those things that myself and some others from Toro are participating in. And we're very excited about that. We do that every year, and has tons of people doing it. And I was asked, we're doing Rancho Cucamonga Water Agency, Valley Water, and I guess they needed an MC because the MC that they had had another appointment. So they asked if I would do that, and I said, yes, I will, as long as they move our booth closer to the main stage so I don't have to run across the whole parking lot to get to the booth. Anyway, we're going to start off. We have some good guests today. The first one everybody knows, and if you haven't read her blogs, you should. She's the purveyor of Maven's Notebook, Ms. Chris Austin. Chris, welcome to the show today.
How you doing, Rob?
I'm doing great. So it's just you and me today, and I know I got you for the first few minutes.
Okay, hey, no problem.
No, I know that. And I know there's lots of things going on in the water business, lots of things going on with the world itself, but a couple of different things. I hear that the proposed federal budget includes funds to raise Shasta Dam.
Oh, my, and isn't this controversial? As is everything in California water, but it was actually surprising to me because raising Shasta Dam is one of the things that I haven't ever heard anybody really talk about much. And actually, the state of California is not interested in participating in this project, and I believe actually passed some sort of legislative directive that they would not participate in this project. And the federal government has to have some kind of local partner in order to build this project, because, you know, they've had problems with this through the early years of, you know, water projects. So the feds cannot come in and unilaterally build a water project in any state, I believe, without some local partner there. And the state has said it isn't going to be us. And so this one was really kind of surprising that this one showed up. But, you know, presumably the local partner would be perhaps Westland, which would have a great interest in raising Shasta Dam.
Absolutely.
So it's like it's a surprise. But, you know, it's a very different world there in Washington, D.C. these days.
Every day it's a different day in Washington, D.C.
Watch the Twitter feed.
Yeah, I wonder what the odds are in Vegas for all these changes.
I don't know. It sure seems like chaos to me, but you know, yeah. What can I say? You know, I don't believe that they even have a head administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency for the Western Region, which is headquartered in San Francisco. No one wants to be the unpopular person killing all the programs going on in San Francisco.
No,
apparently. It's apparently a big thing throughout the whole administration is this lack of federal appointees. So we sort of limp along and see what happens. But this is a surprise, a rider in the omnibus bill.
Well, I'm just, you know, the older I get and the more I live here, or actually anywhere in the U.S., it's getting to be so political. You know, people get voted in because they want to make changes and they want to help and do all these great things. And then they get into office and then things change, but not the way they said they were going to change. And everybody gets politically biased on one side versus the other. And instead of saying, hey, I was elected to come here and do for the people, do for the good of the people, good of the city, the state, the federal government, all of that. And it just seems to be headbutting every day, and nothing seems to change. I mean, I used to joke at the term NATO, you know NATO that they have in the and you know, it's supposed to be North American Treaty Organization. I have a different description for what NATO should be. It's no action, talk only. And I see a lot of that, I just want to see things come faster. We got to be able to trim the bureaucracy to get to where we got to get to and get these things fixed. You know, without water, we can't live here. We can't be here. We won't be alive. And that's got to change. I know there's a study going on. You can tell our audience a little about that suggests solutions are close by for the Valley residents without clean water. I guess there's lots of, aside from Flint, Michigan, California's got its share of bad water as well.
Oh, yeah, it's really quite a problem throughout the Central Valley. I think that the estimates are, I think it's more than 100,000 that have contaminated water. I think it's actually more like a million. But what they found doing some studies is that in the Central Valley, some of these smaller water systems could merge into larger water systems and be better managed and be, receive better quality water than they're getting now. The problem is that when you have these really small water systems, they're expensive to run on a micro scale, and these communities are often poor and can't really afford to bring in the expertise to run these small water systems. But if you could merge these with larger systems in the area, it would really solve a lot of the problem.
Yeah, almost like a co-op kind of thing.
Yeah, but you know, the problem is that the perspective from the water district that now has to absorb this smaller area, more poorly run water, service, is that's going to drain their resources and their personnel to do that. But I think that we need to solve this problem of these people that have, water they can't use coming out their tap.
Right.
And we have to solve it some way, and it's going to cost some people something. So how are we going to do that? There's a proposal in the legislature, and I think it's a budget trailer bill, and they've been actually debating it the last couple days up there in Sacramento, is to have impose what they're calling a water tax, or be 95 cents per household throughout the state of California, that would go into a fund to help serve these disadvantaged communities, these smaller communities with this contaminated water. So you could do it that way, or you could, make these larger water districts in the area take on these other costs. And
well, I thought there was a surplus of money that the state had from all these other taxes that they've been doing for the last couple of years. At least that's what was reported.
Well, the rainy day fund, we have a rainy day fund, which is in good shape. But when it comes to, spending money for specific things and it's coming out of the general.
Well, you got people's lives. You have people's livelihood and businesses. I mean, it all depends on water. I mean, it's not like it's something totally bizarre. I guess it's like I've always said, they need to put their priorities in place to see what's number one, number two, and number three, and go for that and fix those problems, then move on to the next. But I don't know.
I don't think it ever ends. The problem is, I don't think you ever solve anything.
No, that's kind of a shame.
We're in no danger of solving this problem and becoming out of work. But, you know, I think really what it all boils down to, especially in today's political climate, I think it really, you really need to get collaborative solutions.
Yep.
Because collaborative solutions, the ones where all the stakeholders are involved, those are the solutions that last. And we don't need to look any further than this change in administration to see what happens when only one side of the aisle runs things.
Right.
And when it switches, then it's all about taking down what the other people, what the other side put in place.
Exactly.
If we want to have a durable solution, we need both sides at the table.
Right. And like I said, they got to come to the table thinking, hey, we got to solve a problem that they were, you know, elected to do or nominated to do or appointed, and solve the problem and get the political stuff away. I mean, we all got to live together. We all got to survive. And again, without water, we disappear.
Yeah, I know. It's as simple as that.
Yeah. And I just hope somebody can do something. Hey, you know, it rained the last couple of days. It's supposed to rain tomorrow and maybe into the weekend. And it says this week's storms could dump 100 inches of snow.
Okay, but how much is 100 inches of snow?
Well, sounds good. That's how they publish
it. I mean, when you look at it, what is that? I mean, I had to do the math. I was trying to figure out what about 9-10 feet of snow. I mean, it's not. We've had storms like that.
Yeah.
But aren't we glad for that?
Yes.
But I love the way the newspaper headlines like to try and, you know, dial it down.
Well, I think, you know, they want attention. They want you to read. They come up with statistics and shape it the way they want to present it, so people are either real happy about it or they're not happy about it. But it's all to get the readership. But you're right, 100 inches isn't a whole lot, and it's not going to
well,
last.
But it is a nice, healthy storm.
Oh, it's better. It's better than nothing.
Very
absolutely.
Glad to have it.
Absolutely, we want all the rain we can get.
All the rain and all the snow, please, please come and yeah. But not enough to start the mud float.
No, well,
or no flood risk. We want up until that point, but no more.
But you know, I think. You know, I think it's like people who buy homes on top of mountains and then the mountain falls down when there's an earthquake and things like that, or you live by the ocean and you get the, you know, the waves coming in and wiping your property, you know, a foot a year or whatever, 6 inches a year. Don't you think there's studies and things that people should learn about and know about, or the people who sell the properties? So why would you take a risk on those things? I mean, it's
you know, I agree. We have almost, I think, in this country, this unrealistic idea that you buy a piece of property and it's frozen in time. No neighbor will build up something that looks into your backyard. No more traffic will go in front of your street than is there now. But times change and things change. Mm. And, you know, I learned this lesson myself, and I won't go into the long story. But if you buy a piece of property, it's your business to know what's going on with that piece of property and the other ones around it.
Right.
And if there's undeveloped property nearby, you best educate yourself what plans there are for it.
Yep.
So well, you're not surprised when the signs go up, you
no.
know.
Well, I know a couple of years ago my wife said, hey, we should go buy a cabin up in Lake Arrowhead or Big Bear. So we one weekend we trekked up there and spent the weekend looking at things. We looked at Lake Arrowhead first, and I was, you know, we looked through these homes that they're showing us, and some of them, when you walk into the balcony, I guess, out of the house, because it's, when you drive up, you're on street level, but what you don't notice until you go around the side or go out the back door, it's on 20 to 30 foot pylons. And I'm thinking, if one of those rot out, and how do you go to inspect them? Because there's nothing below your balcony except this 30-foot thing going down into the ground, and it's this empty space between that. So what happens when it rots or it breaks? Where your house is going to go? It's going to go down the hill. And that was a little scary, so we didn't buy anything there.
Yeah, that's like those houses up in Beverly Glen.
Oh.
You know, I don't know how I could sleep at night. No. Knowing I was hanging that far off the cliff.
No, not at all. I definitely don't want to do any of that stuff.
But you know what? I'm in no danger of being able to afford that kind of a home. Not have to worry.
Yeah, and I don't know how they get insurance for stuff like that because, you know, it's kind of strange, but I don't know. Hey, I also hear that there's some grant money coming to research conservation technologies in this three-ring tree study. It's talking about the drought and said it was the last big one was when Columbus came in the New World.
Yeah, you know, California's had a history of some very deep droughts, and, you know, this could be the start of, you know, a long-term drought pattern. So we're trying to figure out what we're going to do about it. They're having a workshop in April down in San Pedro on, you know, this report and how water agencies can use this for drought planning.
Yep. Well, there's a lot of stuff going on. Again, how do we just accelerate it?
I don't know, but we'll see. You know, we're all kind of waiting to see what happens with these Delta tunnels. You know, they actually had a report out earlier this week, I think it was on Monday, a report out UC Davis that, you know, they say maybe the Delta tunnels would help the fish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because it would be eliminating some of these reverse flows. But again, very controversial for those, you know, that are opposed to the tunnels. They disagree, you know, with the finding. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty on a lot of things. And
what's,
I don't know.
What's going to convince everybody to get on the same page? What do you think? I mean,
you know, I think that there are always going to be those that are opposed to this type of project in the Delta. And I don't think there's any way you're going to be able to sway certain people.
Mm-hmm.
It just, you know, because it goes back down to people and their own property. And we are talking about family farms, fifth-generation family farms. I mean, there's corporate agriculture, but that big ag stuff that people talk about exists in the Central Valley. It's not in the Delta. You know, there are literally farms you drive by that say established 1860. And that's the truth. And these, and you know, there's a group of people there, and they kind of spread throughout the state that are just never going to accept it.
Yeah.
I don't know what the answer is. I don't. You know, can Southern California survive without imported water? I don't think so.
Yeah.
And personally, you know, there's so many people down here politically. I don't see how we're going to be cut off from imported water coming from somewhere.
Right.
When push comes to shove. But, you know, we could plan for something that works, or we could fail into something that's going to be much worse for, you know, emergency planning is never how
yep.
you would want to go about this. So I don't know, but we'll have to see what happens,
yeah.
you know.
It's scary when you think about it. I mean, when you think about all the, you know, you think if you break it down from the 50,000 foot level, water is certainly a critical issue for California. But then break that down even further of how many subsets of that it affects, and it's like the Salton Sea. How long has that problem been in existence? How long is somebody going to take to decide what we're going to do? Are we going to do anything with it? Or how do we get rid of the smell and all this other stuff that's happening?
Or how? Yeah, mm-hmm. I don't. That's such a conundrum. I don't know how you're going to do that.
Yeah.
I mean, how long can the Imperial Valley receive one-fifth of the flow of the Colorado River? The first one-fifth, because they're some of the oldest rights on the Colorado River.
Right.
Theoretically, when that river gets really low, people, Arizona, Las Vegas, are supposed to let that water flow down to the Imperial Valley. How long is that going to be able to happen? Are we going to be able to dry out our urban centers because of that? I don't know. I mean, it's to me, I think some of these older constructs that we have in place are really going to be tested by our new climate and new reality.
Right.
You know, the State Water Project brings 30% of Southern California's water, 30%. So you may say, well, that's not much. But, okay, so I turn to you and I say, okay, I'm giving you 30% less of your income. Go deal with that. It's not easy.
No.
You'd make some painful, you'd probably likely have to make some painful cuts.
Yep.
And, you know, so is it possible for Southern California to survive with 30% less water when you also think that the Colorado River supplies are also being stressed at the same time? I mean, we've lived through some severe drought restrictions, you know. Can we conserve stormwater? Is it enough?
Yeah.
You know?
Well, we had Inge Biskoner on from our micro irrigation group. She presented a study a couple of years ago at a water efficiency summit, part of the Irrigation Association. One of the things that was very interesting is that the money they spent, or the money that was raised to go for the the cash for grass, and how much water did it really save? You can go ahead and pass. Somebody just walked in the studio. Then, if you see him pass the screen, we say hi. Anyway, the money that they spent and how much the return or of water that they saved was minuscule compared with what they could have done if they gave some of those rebates to the farming industry, because they would have saved gazillions of water. And but again, we do have smart people in the industry. That's a fact. And if we bring them to the table and they know what to do, the next step is you got to push it up the ladder to the political side. And I think that's where it's hurting, that, because I know we got smart. I mean, I take a look at what Orange County is doing with recycling water, and they call it the toilet to tap. But, you know, it's producing water that's clean, drinkable. They're not the only ones in the country that are doing stuff like this. And I think that's important.
It is. But the one thing you have to remember is that when it comes to recycling water, you first have to have water to use.
Yes.
In order to recycle.
Yep.
You know, so again, we turn back to imported water, because we only have water resources for 50%. 50% is groundwater, is local resources.
Yep.
And, you know, can we desalinate? Can we capture storm water? What can we do? Is that enough to make up for that other 50%? You know, some people tell you yes. Some people say no. I don't know. I would hate to be the water manager that has to be making this kind of decision.
Yep, I totally agree. I guess, you know, I used to joke with Mike about the water train, the guy who owns that company, where he went out and bought 132 rail cars, tanker things, and moving water all over. You know, he may be the savior of it all, so who knows? Well, Chris, I'm going to let you go. We're up against the break. I will talk to you next week on World Water Day, and I hope you're doing well, and we'll catch up with you next time.
Okay, great. Take care.
Okay, stick around, everybody. We'll be back to the Water Zone on KCEA 1050 AM, and stick around again.
This is the Schmitz Yard. Company's coming soon, and oh, Schmidt, their deck and outdoor furniture's been dominated by dirt. But no worries, there's plenty of time for Scott's Outdoor Cleaner Plus OxyClean to work its magic. Its fast-foaming action lifts dirt and wipes out stains from moss, mold, mildew, and algae. Guaranteed. All while being safe to use around plants and grass. Because when company's coming, dirt's not invited. This is a Scott's Yard. Pick up Scott's Outdoor Cleaner this weekend.
Are you looking for a place to buy your landscape and gardening items? Come visit us at Site One Landscape Supply. We offer a large and quality selection of irrigation, landscape, and outdoor living products such as Toro's water-efficient precision nozzles. Site One Landscape Supply has over 30 locations right here in Southern California, and we are the largest national wholesale distributor of landscape supplies in the United States. Site One's knowledgeable and friendly staff is equipped to help you with all your landscape, irrigation, and outdoor living projects. Whether you're redoing your backyard into a drought-tolerant garden or creating a water-efficient landscape for your client, Site One has everything you need, including the latest in water-saving technologies, drought-tolerant plants for your yard, irrigation supplies, fertilizer and weed control products, landscape accessories, hardscape products, outdoor lighting, and much, much more. Visit SiteOne.com to find a store near you or stop by today. SiteOne, we are stronger together.
Hey, welcome back to the Water Zone. I hope everybody's having a great afternoon. And we got a very good, interesting guest coming on. It's a gentleman named Mr. Tim Worley. And he's a person who really got his feet wet in this industry. And he is the executive director of the American Water Works Association. So I'd like to welcome Tim to the show. Tim, how are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Glad to be on the Water Zone with you.
We appreciate that very much. We've been trying to get somebody from your organization, and I heard you're one of the best guys, and that's what we went after. So how did you get your feet wet in this industry? A little background about yourself, if you can.
Well, first, Rob, I just want to clarify that I'm executive director of one section.
Yes, the California and Nevada. Sorry, I should have said that.
Yes, exactly.
I was giving you a promotion.
Well,
I was trying to get you more money, that, you know.
But the real executive director, CEO, is my friend, so I don't know about that.
Oh, okay.
Well, I came to Southern California with an interest in natural resources and studied public policy at the Claremont Graduate University, got my master's and doctorate in that, and during that time, I started working part-time and then full-time for one of the local water districts, and it's been a good home for me ever since then.
Wow. So
that's been over 20 years now.
Wow. Yeah, we're getting involved with Sustainable. I'm sure you know about Sustainable Claremont.
Yes.
Yeah, we're going to be at that event as well. So that should be a big deal. So can you explain to our, I mean, I know what AWWA is, but can you explain it to our listening audience and what's its purpose? And especially from the 50,000 foot and then more into what your section is.
Yeah, well, American Water Works Association has been around a long time, really since 1881 is when it first started. And at that time, of course, it was really just beginning to be understood how to prevent some of the waterborne illness from cholera or typhoid, some of those waterborne diseases. And since then, it's spread throughout North America. So it's not only the oldest, I think, but also the largest water organization of any kind in the world, with over 50,000 members, mostly throughout North America. And there are some overseas members, and there's been an office in India, actually, for a couple of years. So that's an interesting development. But here at the California-Nevada section, and with most of the sections and the association as a whole, our focus really is on helping our members stay on top of the very latest information and spread the knowledge about water, everything from water as a source to water treatment. But our core mission has really always been to ensure that people have adequate, reliable supplies of safe water for all uses.
Now, is it my understanding correct that each of the different sectors or sections have committees that are specialized in different things?
Yeah, that's true. There is quite a number of different topic areas or subjects that our members are interested in. And here at our section, we have over 40 special technical committees that work on everything from meters to water loss control to pipe and you name it. So we have a lot of involvement from volunteers, and that's really where the strength of our organization comes from, is volunteers helping each other. In a way, you could almost consider an association like this an old-fashioned form of crowdsourcing, where people who have some new knowledge share it through the association with their peers, and it's been working very well for a long time.
Because I believe you have one committee that specializes in drinking water and pollutants, and you do a lot of best management practices, and as you said, you try to develop guidelines, I guess is the good word for it, and then share that with not only California but all across the industry.
Yeah, we do focus here on issues that are, well, for instance, regulations that come out from state governments here in California and Nevada, and try to work with our state government entities to ensure that not only is the drinking water safe, but the way we interact with the environment and natural water sources is also up to the very best standards of practice. And so we do sometimes create guidebooks, guidance documents, and sometimes we interact with the state on in other ways, you know, commenting on some regulations that they may propose to represent the best knowledge of our members, so that what state and local governments do is, you know, makes the most sense for everybody.
Right. I was reading today that up in the San Francisco Bay, they found four kinds of algae toxins.
Yeah, those toxins are a very big concern. Just in recent years, it's been an increasing focus, and we're very concerned about it. You know, we have some of the best scientific experts working on how to prevent it, well, treat it in the water systems, but also one of the best things that we can all do is to prevent it from getting into the water systems in the first place. One of the big focal points right now, in fact, is to work with agriculture to prevent some of the nutrients and also pesticides, but especially nutrients that can feed that algal growth from getting into the sources of drinking water. This has been a big problem in the Great Lakes states several years, and here in the western states as well. It's an increasing concern, and we need to work together with government, with agriculture, and with the drinking water suppliers to try and address the problem.
Is it a lot from the farming point of view, or maybe from the dairy industry? Do you see?
Well, yeah, it kind of depends on what is happening in the in that local area. It will vary from, you know, from one part of the country or even one part of the state to another. You know, I'm sure that with your focus on irrigation and a lot of your guests focus on irrigation and agricultural practices, we want to make sure that irrigation is done in the most efficient way possible, and also make sure that there are barriers and such that will keep runoff from getting into natural sources of drinking water, so that we keep the nutrients, the fertilizers that are so important, where they belong and in the quantities that they should be used, so that we don't create a problem for neighbors somewhere else.
Right. I know, you know, most of the companies who build smart irrigation controllers such as us also, you know, teaching and educating people about that, even in the landscape industry, that, you know, you need to know what kind of soil you have. You need to know what the saturation rate is. You need, you know, and even if you didn't know the soil or any of that, you turn them on and you time until you see the puddle. And then you turn it off and you know. But a lot of people don't do that. And same, I guess it's even more dramatic in the farming industry, because depending on what kind of irrigation they're using, you know, do they use central pivots? Do they use any type of other overhead? Do they use micro-irrigation? Do they use flooding? You know, there's all different types. And you're right, the runoff is a big, serious problem. And especially for, I'll even use homeowners associations, big condominium areas. You know, when they hire a landscape contractor, you know, the contractor's job is to make the place look nice. It has to have curb appeal. And if the grass ain't green, the people who live there get upset. If the flowers aren't blooming, the people get upset. So what do? They keep watering, a lot. They keep putting fertilizer down a lot. And you just keep getting this recycling issue of all this pollutants and water just draining down the street, unfortunately.
And it's very true, Rob, and hopefully your show and all of our members can help educate people on using water more efficiently, and irrigation is certainly a big part of that.
Yep. Now, you do, I know in looking more, I'm not a member of the AWWA, but I was thinking that that's something I'd probably would like to do. But I know you have lots of education programs available, and you do a lot of good things that with certification programs. Can you tell us a little about those?
Yeah, I'd be glad to. We do offer certification in 6 different professional disciplines for members working in those fields within the water industry, as we call it, from backflow prevention and cross-connection control to operations, treatment, and distribution systems. And we have one that's fairly unique to us that focuses on water use efficiency, as a matter of fact. And in this part of the world, there's quite a number of people who work in that at the water utilities, and so we've developed a certification to help ensure that they are well-trained, know the best practices, and that's something that we're really pretty proud of. But a lot of our focus really is on educating our members and people within the water utilities. And one of the big projects that we're just wrapping up, in fact, is focusing on water loss control within the water systems themselves. There's a new requirement in California, and it's kind of a trend across the whole United States to have utilities take a closer look at their water balance, meaning just like you would balance the books on for a financial audit, it can be done similarly with water, where a utility can look over the course of a year at all the water coming into their system from their own production or from purchasing it from some other entity, and how does that compare to where the water ended up on the other side of the equation. And it's kind of a new practice, but a requirement now in California, at least, and several other states, to use that water audit. Here in California, in fact, they required the use of some free software for that purpose developed by the American Water Works Association. But as I said, it's kind of a new practice for a lot of utilities, and so we launched a very extensive training and technical assistance program that's just wrapping up for this phase at least. And so with this new requirement being an annual audit, we're hoping that utilities will continue to learn more and more about how to make this water audit work for them so they can really tackle the most economical losses in their systems and prevent leaks, but also find some of the sources of revenue that they may be losing if meters are running inaccurately or that sort of thing. So it's, you know, that's just an example of one of the most extensive education programs we've been active with. But we have a very robust and thorough education program covering everything from security and emergency preparedness to, as I said, meters and groundwater wells and all manner of operational issues.
It's amazing that the public really doesn't have an in-depth knowledge of the water industry. I'm sure when the drought hit, you talked about financial revenue. I'm sure it dropped a lot when everybody had to start conserving, and you still have to have operations to run. And do you get involved? I know it's part of, I consider it part of water, but the actual pumping and moving of water, obviously we all know that costs a lot of money to do. Is a lot of water agencies or water people worried about the startups of pumps? Are they going to battery backup storage and things of that sort to help reduce the operating costs? Because you know, when you got to cut water 25 to 28% across the state, or we had to before, what happens with the revenue? You see less of that, and they still need to operate. The stuff can't stop, and you can't just keep reducing that. You have to keep it going. Is that something that you guys get involved with?
Yeah, it is. Well, our members are on the front lines of that, and so we try and support them in whatever way we can. There are some practices that that agencies can use to plan for that kind of loss of revenue. It, you know, a lot depends on how the water rates are structured, not necessarily just where the level or the price of water is set, but how is the rate structured, because there's a nice balance to be found between sort of the fixed revenue, which covers the operation that will need to happen, whether you're moving a small amount of water or, you know, all the water in the world when demand is very high. So that's really important, and there are a lot of resources within AWWA published, and also sometimes there are workshops that can be held to really assist our members in understanding how to manage those swings in both revenue and water supply.
I had picked up a document, the water rate setting under Prop 218 guidebook. You're probably familiar with that.
That's something we just recently published. Headquarters in Denver, Colorado is a big publishing operation. They have manuals of practice covering everything under the sun, and they also set standards that water utilities rely on for all types of products and even management practices. But here we don't do a lot of publishing. We'll develop guidance on certain practices and so forth, best management practices. But we found that a lot of people within our members really have a hard time understanding the real complex issues of rate setting with under the constraints of Proposition 218 and some of the case law and additional voter of past initiatives that really set a very complicated framework for water rates in California. So what we've done with that little book is to try and boil it down in simple, non-legal terms. It has a legal basis to it, because we certainly had one of the best legal minds on this issue working with us to write the book. But we tried to keep it in very much more layman's language and keep a lot of the legalese to footnotes, so that people can really understand how to set rates appropriately and get adopted without ending up in a big protracted legal battle over it.
Right. I know if my co-host was here today, I know the questions he would be asking and the comments he'd be making. I know Mike and I have always talked about the true value of water. We've had on people such as the Consulate General of Israel, an author named Seth Siegel. I don't know if you're familiar with him and his works, and did a lot of work with the Israeli government. You know, it's when, and this is Mike's analogy. When you go get gas for your car, you put the hose in, the nozzle in your thing, and you press the button and it starts to go. And as you're standing there, you can see how much gas you're pumping and what it costs immediately. Unfortunately, with water, you don't know until you get your bill. So you don't get that. You don't get that instantaneous feedback. But I do believe there's some water agencies that have some new software that's available to people where they can actually look on every single day. Because most people, I know, can't go out and understand their water meter. They don't know how to read it. And, you know, and there's, you know, I know a lot of water agencies who go out and try to teach people, you know, you put this in your toilet and you can tell if it's leaking, and you go around, you turn everything off, and then you go look at your meter. But again, a lot of people don't know that. They don't get that instant feedback until they get their bill, and then they're shocked. You know, gee, I'm in tier one now, you know, or whatever, or tier four, and it scares them a little bit for that. Do you think someday not only in California, but the United States. If you compare us to other countries who really do value the value of water more than we do. Because water is dirt cheap, basically, I mean, to everybody here. And you watch countries like Israel, who's developed all kinds of technology, especially in agriculture, where they're even experimenting with water that has more salts in them and things of that sort, and making the vegetation more stronger that they can take that. I mean, do you think we're going to have to get to that level within the next 10, 20 years here?
Well, I think we are moving in that direction. I think it will take a while for people to really, truly understand the value of the product and what all goes into that service that they have on demand 24/7, 365 days a year, and what a true value that is to them. But I think that some smart technologies, smart meters, and real-time information to the consumer is going to help that, and we'll see more and more water utilities adopting that kind of system so that it really can provide that information that utilities that homeowners and customers need to really understand what they're getting and where the water is used and how it's used and how they can be better consumers, more informed consumers. So we're moving in that direction, I think, Rob, but it's going to take some time before most people really have that sense of just what a tremendous value it is.
Right. I see in the building industry, for example, their advocacy where they go argue with water districts and cities for the hookup fees, because they can range anywhere from, I'm making a number here, $800 up to $25,000 to hook up a meter. And I know that's preventing them from building, the housing market to enlarge. That's just one of the small portions of what's happening. But do you think that'll ever go down? Because I agree with you. I think to have instantaneous data is important. I always joke as an engineer saying, in God we trust, all others bring data. I have to go by the science and know immediately. I don't like suppositions or guesses or any of that. You gotta have hardcore facts. But there's a cost for technology. And then in our industry, in the irrigation, for the last 15 years, everybody's been pushing to develop, smart controllers and smarter electronics and more efficient spray nozzles and things of that sort. But there is a cost to that. And then people, when you say, okay, here it is, and it costs this much, and then they, I don't want to spend that much. I just want to, it's just a timer. It just turns on and turns off. And why do I need all this other stuff? And then the worst part about that is that people they think you set it and forget it and walk away. And a lot of water agencies go out and they try to educate the people. They give them rebates or even do a direct install for new controllers and new irrigation stuff. And the people touch it. And maybe every day or every other day the water came on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, but it's a cooler time, and Wednesday comes and Ma says to Pa, hey, it didn't water the lawn today. We need to go out and turn it on some more, and so then they defeat the purpose of having intelligence to do that. And yeah. I think people are afraid. People want technology. They like it. But they're also afraid of it, and they don't understand it well enough. And I knew one person from a water agency, very nice person. I won't mention the person's name. But they tell me they like to go out in their garage every day and adjust their controller based on the ET data that they get off the computer. And I go, but there's equipment to do that. You don't have to do that. Don't touch it. So,
yeah. Well, technology is a helpful tool, but it's not a panacea. And there are some shortcomings, just like you've been talking about. But I think that it's coming gradually, and I think it's going to be a long educational process to get people to understand how to use it appropriately. But it's a trend that we're seeing, and I think that will continue.
Yeah, I know they always have that addict that it's hard to change the habits of an old dog. And we're finding going to schools and younger schools how more in tune they are. We started a program with elementary schools and gave everybody a whistle. And the program is basically, you know, blow the whistle on wasted water. And so we tell the kids, anytime you see somebody wasting water, blow the whistle. And kind of works. They think it's fun. We did that for a National Mayor's Challenge for Water Conservation at the Mall of America last year in April. Yeah. And you had hundreds of kids blowing their whistles at the same time. It was loud, but everybody got the note. Hey,
that's good.
Yeah, on the advocacy initiatives, you have several that are very interesting, and maybe you can just talk just a little about them, like the promoting tap water purity. I think that's absolutely important, as well as urban conservation. Some others. Can you fill us in a little on those?
Yeah. Well, tap water purity, that's something that's near and dear to our heart. We regularly interact with our regulators who set drinking water standards, and you mentioned earlier some of the algal toxins, the big looming issue on the drinking water side, on the source water. That's something that we'll be watching very closely and looking for solutions to come out of the regulatory agencies on that issue. Conservation is another one. You know, we really, I think all of our members in principle support the idea that Governor Brown said, let's make conservation a California way of life. And I think we really believe that in our hearts and in our practices, but it's sometimes challenging to take a principle like that and translate it into regulations that work well for everybody, given the diversity of geography and economic activity and population and climate and so forth. So, you know, we're trying to be a voice for our members on that front. Nationally, I mentioned the issues about agricultural runoff and so forth that can contribute to source water problems. And with the Farm Bill under consideration this coming year, we're hoping that we can be a voice for some good common sense provisions that will help reduce and minimize those problems, working with agriculture as much as we can, and certainly with our members of Congress as they grapple with the, you know, very big and complex bill like that.
Yep.
But those are some of the examples. You know, it kind of, we watch to see what issues are most concerning to our members. And one of the things that we're trying to figure out a solution to is those very small systems in many parts of the country. Certainly true here in California, where they may not have the technical expertise. In many cases, they may be virtually operated by volunteers without any professional operations at all. And those systems have a very difficult time in meeting drinking water regulations. And it's a problem. It's not affecting the vast majority of the population. But even anyone in California in this day and age, or any other state, without access to safe drinking water is a concern to us. And we're hoping that we can be a productive constructive voice on that issue in the coming weeks ahead.
Okay. Well, as we're getting close to the end here up at the news hour, just real quickly, what major events and conferences you got going coming up, and how can people reach you? And we certainly want to have you and some of your representatives back to get into more things, talk about infrastructure and pollutant discharge and chromium and a whole bunch of other topics that are pretty interesting that people don't know about. I mean, outside the industry, but I think it's important that people learn about it. The more they know, they can make intelligent decisions. You can't make an intelligent decision unless you have intelligent facts.
Right. Yeah, well, that would be great, Rob. We'd love to be regular guests on your show. And, yeah, we have several events coming up that range in size from only a couple hundred folks. At the end of this month, we have an operator symposium one of the neat features of that is that's where we have some operator competitions and tapping pipe and putting together a meter and putting together a fire hydrant, all racing against your peers. That's March 27th and 28th up in Burlingame.
If you, I didn't